Good morning. You're listening to WYSO in Yellow Springs. We have the Book Nook coming up this morning. I'm Vic McCunis, and we're going to welcome a special guest to the show today. On April 18th, 1942, a group of daring men led by Jimmy Doolittle took off from the deck of the aircraft carrier the Hornet in bombers and proceeded to fly 800 miles on a bombing mission of Japan. We'll be talking about Doolittle's Raiders. His book is Target Tokyo, coming up in the Book Nook this morning. But first, National Public Radio News. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today James M. Scott. He has just published a new work of history. It's called Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. He joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vic, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What got you involved on this project? Wow, this is quite a bit of work you put in here.
Well, you know, to start off, I'll say I didn't expect the book to be quite as big as it turned out to be. In fact, it was contracted to be about 100,000 words, which would have ended up being about a typical 300-page book or so. And then by the time I finished it, it was about 225,000 words. So it was twice as long as it was supposed to be. But the story just sort of spiraled out. And the Doolittle Raid, which is what the book is about, is just, it's truly one of the best stories of World War II. It's the story of America's revenge for the attack on Pearl Harbor. Soon after the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, President Roosevelt gathered with his senior military staff and said, we need to find a way to take the fight back to the Japanese. And I don't mean an attack on a far-flung island in the Japanese Empire. We need to find a way to strike back directly at Tokyo. And so out of that demand grew the Doolittle Raid, which took place in April 18th, 1942. It was a one-way mission for 80 volunteer airmen flying 16 bombers off an aircraft carrier in the Pacific to fly, bomb Tokyo, and then escape to free China. And then once they got to China, then they had to find sort of their way home, if you will, with the Japanese army chasing after them. So it really... The Doolittle Raid is just, it on so many different levels, it's just really one of the most fascinating stories of World War II. It's a political story. It's a story of a nation after it's been knocked down in the attack on Pearl Harbor, desperate for a way to strike back, for the president to assure the American people that through this action, that this symbolic action, that that America will pull through in the end. And it's an incredible adventure story and heroism of these 80 young men who took off, uncertain as to whether they'd make it. So it really, the Doolittle Raid, for me, and sort of looking at World War II stories, I mean, it offered so much in terms of story, characters, everything.
Tell us about their charismatic leader, Jimmy Doolittle. Who was this guy? Why were they all so loyal to him?
Absolutely. You know, Jimmy Doolittle is hands down, I think, probably one of the most fascinating individuals of the 20th century. He was born in Alameda, California in 1896, and his father relocated the family really early on up to Alaska, where he was an unsuccessful gold prospector. And so Doolittle really, and at this time, Alaska was still very much like a frontier. And so, you know, Doolittle grew up in this in Nome, in this really sort of rugged town, and he was very small. He was only 5 feet 4 inches tall, and so in order to protect himself and to sort of, you know, he learned how to fight. And he ultimately became so good at it, he became a professional boxer. He eventually came back to California and started school at the University of California and was considering going into mining, and then World War I broke out. And he enlisted in World War I and fell in love with flying. And that really, you know, his love of flying would change the rest of his life, change the direction of it and everything. So he didn't actually see combat in World War I. He trained people who did. In fact, he griped that he set out World War I and his job was to train people to go off and be heroes, and his job was to make more heroes. But he was a very incredibly gifted pilot. In fact, I pulled his Air Force evaluations. from the National Archives. And very early on in his career, his senior officers were commenting that he's, quote, you know, the most daring, skillful aviator the Air Service has. I mean, things of that nature. And so he was really an amazing pilot, and he came about at a time when aviation was still really young. And so the nation was, pilots were constantly testing themselves, trying to break new records. Doolittle, in fact, was the first person to ever fly cross country in less than a day. He also won a lot of racing titles as well. But beyond just his piloting skills, he was a really brilliant scientist. And in fact, he went to MIT, and he earned his master's and his doctorate degree in MIT. And he ultimately would really help solve one of the biggest hurdles of early aviation, which is how could pilots fly without being able to see where they were going in situations like night and fog and things like that. And so Doolittle actually helped develop the artificial horizon, which is still standard on airplanes today. And he's also the first person ever to fly solely on instruments. I mean, it's an amazing feat he accomplished in a hooded cockpit.
Mm.
So, and he'd done all of those things before World War II.
Mm.
And so when World War II breaks out, he gets tapped to be the staff troubleshooter for the head of the Army Air Force at that time, General Hap Arnold. And so Doolittle's job is to sort of sort out aviation problems. And so during that early, you know, this first few weeks of the war, when Roosevelt's pressing his senior leaders for a way to strike back at Japan, who then does this fall to in the Air Service? Well, Jimmy Doolittle. And who's better positioned to be able to figure out the logistics of this operation and to pull it off? I mean, the Doolittle raid was, it was the mission that Jimmy Doolittle was born to lead.
James M. Scott joins us. His book is Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. I think it's easy to forget what Pearl Harbor meant because it really crippled the United States militarily. And the one thing that was a blessing about it was that our aircraft carriers were not at Pearl Harbor that day, because had they been, that might have changed history. And you track the Japanese viewpoint during this, and you look into what the admiral who was the brains behind the Pearl Harbor attack, Yamamoto, was thinking. And he was worried. He knew that this was crucial, that the carriers had survived that attack, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And you have to remember, you know, that World War II, it's really a World War II is a very defining moment for aviation and for aircraft carriers. And so Yamamoto was a very early one to appreciate just how important aircraft carriers and the would be to this war, and it has everything to do with distances. The Pacific Ocean is 65 million square miles; it's the largest ocean. And so, if you're going to fight a war on such a large battlefield, you need to have mobility, and to be able to take that fight to your enemy. And so, Yamamoto, it was very fortuitous that America's three aircraft carriers that we had in the Pacific Fleet at that time were all absent that Sunday morning of December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese attacked. And while they did a lot of damage to our battleships and killed and injured an awful lot of Americans, I was very fortunate that those carriers weren't there because it allowed us to immediately begin pushing back into Japanese. Now, early on, we treated those aircraft carriers a lot like endangered species because they were too precious to run the risk that we might lose them in a battle. But what we were doing is we were doing raids against sort of outer islands in the Japanese Empire just to try to distract the Japanese from you know, at that point the Japanese were, you know, the Philippines were under siege and they were pushing down and Singapore would soon fall. They would go so far as to attack northern Australia. And so the idea was that if we could continue to attack them elsewhere, they would have to pull more forces back into other areas and it slowed down their conquests. And Yamamoto knew that these aircraft carriers that we were using to sort of target them, it was only a matter of time before we would find a way for them to come back and target Tokyo. And so his big insistence was how we need to find some battle, if you will, that will lure the American carriers back into fight, where we can have sort of a battle with them where they don't sort of attack and retreat. And the Doolittle Raid, and that of course ultimately happened with the Battle of Midway in June 1942, which the Doolittle Raid played a very important role in. At that time after the attack on Pearl Harbor and after the fall of the Philippines, the Japanese were trying to decide in which direction they were going to go next for their expansion and whatnot. And Yamamoto was really pushing that the Japanese needed to continue to confront the Americans and try to take Midway with the hopes of luring those aircraft carriers into battle. And he was getting a lot of pushback from others, not only in the Navy, but also in the Japanese Army. And so when Doolittle and his men actually attacked Tokyo, everyone else said, Yamamoto's right. These aircraft carriers that are still out there are still a threat, you know, and they green-lighted the plan for Midway. And Midway, for folks who follow naval history, was this pivotal battle in June of 1942, in which the Japanese lost four aircraft carriers in a 24-hour period, and it shifted the balance of power in the Navy back in favor of the United States. And all of this really happened in part because of the Doolittle raid. You know, this one raid with these 80 volunteer airmen, you know, it so rattled the Japanese leadership that it allowed Yamamoto to go forward with his plan to attack Midway. So it had a big strategic outcome as well.
The Japanese had been supremely overconfident up until the point where the Doolittle raid occurred, and you are so meticulous about documenting how this raid took place. You take us to the nuts and bolts of it and the amazing facts that undergirded the attack, because for one thing, these guys had to figure out how to fit a bunch of bombers onto an aircraft carrier. This was absurd on the face of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it had never been thought of. And because, you know, at that time, American carrier aircraft were single-engine planes. They were torpedo bombers and fighter planes and whatnot. And the planes that Doolittle and his men flew were twin-engine Army B-25 bombers. They were medium bombers. So they were much bigger aircraft. But they had to be bigger aircraft to make the mission work. Had we used Navy planes, we would have had to take a play out of the Japanese playbook like they used at Pearl Harbor, in which we would have had to get our aircraft carriers very close in because the range of these single-engine planes was much, much smaller, just a few hundred miles. So we would have had to then take our very precious aircraft carriers that we were very worried about literally within just a couple of hundred miles of Tokyo, which then would have exposed them to retaliation by the Japanese, which could take the form of long-range Japanese bombers. So, I mean, even if our carriers quickly turned back, you know, these long-range Japanese land-based bombers could fly out for hundreds of miles and attack afterwards. So the plan that Doolittle had to come up with and that the Army and the Navy had to come up with was, how can you get a plane that can carry enough fuel, has two engines and is big enough that it can take off from an aircraft carrier, fly hundreds of miles to Japan and attack its targets, and still then fly all the way to China where they were going to land on some airfields there. The Army planes weren't, you could take off potentially from an aircraft carrier, but they knew that there was no way you could land back on one again. They were just, the tails on them were too fragile for the arresting gear. There was so little clearance between the wingtips and the superstructure of the aircraft carrier. I mean, it's just about 6-7 feet. That any, you know, movement at all on a landing, and it would guarantee a collision. So there wasn't a way for the bombers to come back. They realized, even in the early planning stages. So this had to be a one-way mission, and they knew that pretty much from the beginning. So they ultimately came up with this idea, and it was an idea in theory only. They had to test it, and so they actually took some Army B-25 bombers, and they took them to Norfolk, where the Hornet was under. It was just finishing up its sort of shakedown cruise and everything. It was about to join. It was about to be America's newest carrier at the time, and so they literally took the Hornet right off of Norfolk and they tested a couple of these planes and made sure that it would actually work, and it did. And then they had to train all these Army bombers in the art of carrier takeoffs. You know, how can you take a plane that normally would take, you know, a few thousand feet to take off, and teach these pilots how to do it in less than 500 feet? Mm. And so they brought in a naval carrier pilot, an instructor, and his job was to teach these pilots how to make a big Army bomber take off with the agility of a fighter plane. So it really, I mean, they had to completely, I mean, every stage of the operation had to be sort of rethought out, replanned. I mean, from adding fuel tanks to the bombers to teaching pilots, Army pilots, how to take off like carrier pilots. I mean, it was really just, I mean, it was very ingenious. And to think all of this was done in a matter of about 16 weeks, from the time in which Roosevelt gave his first demands until the time of the execution of the raid on April 18th, was about a 16-week period. So if you think of the logistics involved in pulling all of this off, it's pretty amazing.
It is quite a story, and we are recording this interview in advance, and we're going to be airing it on Saturday morning, April 18th, which is the 73rd anniversary of the Doolittle Raid on Tokyo. And I understand that there's a very significant event happening here in the Dayton area, and you're going to be participating. Can you tell us what's up, James?
Absolutely. The Doolittle Raiders on this Wednesday, on April 15th, are actually going to receive the Congressional Gold Medal by from House Speaker John Boehner and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and their Democratic counterparts Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are going to present the Raiders with the Congressional Gold Medal. And then the Raiders are then going to come to Dayton, and there's going to be on Saturday, sort of late Saturday, early evening, they're going to install this Congressional Gold Medal in the permanent display there at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. So it's really going to be, and the last two, there are two surviving Raiders who are still alive out of their original 80, including 99-year-old Dick Cole, who was Jimmy Doolittle's co-pilot, and Dave Thatcher, who was an engineer and gunner on one of the planes, and a Silver Star recipient as well. So they're the last two surviving out of the original 80, and both of them are going to be in Dayton to install this medal on Saturday in the permanent display that they have there to the National Museum, International Museum of the U.S. Air Force. So it should be a very remarkable event.
And James will be there signing copies of Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. You're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. Now this. In case you just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and today it's my pleasure to have on the program James M. Scott. His book is Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. As you mentioned a moment ago, these guys who were part of the raid, they are fading into the sunset. There's only a couple of them still living. In fact, I think we've lost a couple here recently. Didn't Bobby Height, who was one of the co-pilots who was a prisoner, didn't he just die recently?
He did. Just a couple of weeks ago, he passed away. And, yeah, he was a POW for 40 months. And then also just before that, in late January, we lost Edward Saylor, who was another one of the Raiders. And then last fall, we lost Tom Griffin, who was one of the Raiders. So, yeah, we've lost three just in the last, you know, several months.
And you were in Dayton when they cracked open that 1896 bottle of cognac that was made the same year as Jimmy Doolittle's birth. Weren't you here for that?
I was. That was an amazing experience. That was the final toast in which the Raiders had Jimmy Doolittle. They every year from the end of the war on, with the exception of 2 years that they missed, the Raiders would get together every year to celebrate the anniversary of the raid. And they developed this tradition where they would toast anyone who had passed, any of the Raiders who had passed away. And Jimmy Doolittle presented them with a bottle of 1896 cognac to mark the year he was born. And the tradition was that the last two Raiders who were still alive would get together and would toast the rest of the men. And so they got concerned a couple of years ago because the Raiders were getting so much older in age, and that, you know, with their health and, you know, being most of them all in their 90s, that they didn't want to wait until the last two in case that, you know, those men were in any way unable to make the trip. And so they went ahead and did it early, and they did it with several of the Raiders there in Dayton in a big hangar. And they opened up that bottle and set a toast to the men who passed away. And it was a pretty remarkable experience to be there and witness that.
Well, I hope they saved a little bit for those two guys that are going to be in Dayton for the big event today on the 18th.
It's my understanding they're going to have their own private toast.
Okay. So. Wow. What a thing.
Yeah.
James Scott joins us. His book is Target Tokyo. Let's talk about the actual mission and how you tracked every single one of these planes. This is an amazing bit of scholarship. How did you get all this information? I understand there's been some new archives made available.
Yeah, it was fortunately the Raiders in the Air Force at the time, the Army Air Force at the time, when these guys got to Chungking, China, it was they actually made each one sit down and write a full report on exactly what it was like, what the mission was like. Now, some of the reports are smaller than others, but some of them are very detailed. And those reports, really, you know, written just a couple weeks after the raid, are amazing. You know, these men talk about flying over baseball games. They talk about what it was like to bail out of the planes. I mean, just an incredible amount of detail. And that report is sort of, in years past, has been a hard one for a lot of previous folks who've tried to tackle the Doolittle story to find. It's sort of in an obscure spot in the National Archives. And I was really lucky in the course of my research to find it, because it really allows you to put the reader in that cockpit, you know, to when you're reading the bombardier's report and he's writing in his report what it looked like when he's looking down that bomb site. I mean, you can recreate that for the reader, even though it's seven decades later, and just like they're there. And so, you know, I was really lucky to get that. We were also, this is the first book to tap Japanese archives. And there's been a good bit of Japanese scholarship done on the raid in the last decade or so. And so I was worked with a research assistant translator in Tokyo to take a look at their records. We actually have photographs, never before published photographs in the U.S. of the that are taken on the ground in Tokyo that showed the bomb damage. And also, we have a lot of new material dealing with the Japanese retaliation against the Chinese in the wake of the raid. The Japanese were furious about the raid and set out to make sure that the airfields and the coastal Chinese provinces would never be used by the Americans again, and also to punish the villagers who helped out Doolittle and his men. And so they went in, and it was a pretty horrific slaughter summer of 1942. And in a lot of those records, I was able to find these old missionary records in DePaul University, letters, photos, and whatnot, that really help add that new information into the book as well. So a lot of different angles.
I think that if we were considering a raid like this today, the way this was structured, a lot of us would say this is a suicide mission. And yet all these men were volunteers. And when they would ask them if they wanted to drop out and not participate, not a single one of them dropped out. In fact, there were guys fighting to be included who could not go.
Oh, yeah. Guys who were offering money. Yeah, they were literally offering, you know, a fistful of cash to be able to go on this mission. Yeah, it's pretty incredible. And, you know, I think that these guys were – it's funny. You talk to them later in life and you say, you know, it was a suicide mission. And a lot of these guys, the raiders will say, well, you know, we didn't really think about it that way at the time. And we knew it was dangerous, but, you know, all those kinds of missions were dangerous. So I think, you know, we look at it a little bit older with a little bit more perspective. You know, these guys at the time were – a lot of them were, you know, barely – out of their teens, and some of them were teenagers still, you know, to them it just seemed like an amazing mission, and there was an opportunity to strike back. And it really, you know, it's hard to imagine today, I think, for American audiences, how demoralizing of a time period it was leading up to the raid after the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, we'd lost Guam, we'd lost Wake Island, the Philippines were under siege. I mean, it was a very dark time period in American history, and there was the American population was very demoralized. And so here you were offering these guys an opportunity to get on board this plane, to take off, and to go take that fight directly back to the enemy's capital. And for a lot of these guys, they couldn't pass that up. They wanted to be a part of it.
Mm. You have a great blurb for your book, Target Tokyo. A gentleman who's appeared on this program on a number of occasions said, quote, "When I grew up in the house of a fighter pilot, it was a religious tenet with my father that the Doolittle Raiders were the bravest pilots in the history of flight. James Scott's epic historical work, Target Tokyo, makes that opinion seem almost unassailable. Target Tokyo is one of the most incredible accounts of American military valor I've ever read." Pat Conroy said that. He wasn't damning you with faint praise, was he?
No. I'm very grateful to Pat Conroy for that quote. In fact, when he submitted it to my editor, rather than, you know, sometimes when blurbs come in, he'll just forward them to you by email. My editor actually called me up and said, "I got to read this thing to you." It was very exciting. We were very excited to get that blurb. I mean, I've read every book Pat Conroy has. I've got signed copies of all of them, because I'm from South Carolina. I live in Charleston. And so I, you know, he's a very iconic figure in where I'm from. And so, but it's funny, actually, I ran into Pat Conroy last October at we were out in Nashville at the Southeastern Book Festival, and he actually was reading an advanced copy of Target Tokyo at the time. And so I was chatting with him, and he said to me, he goes, man, that's a big book. And I just thought that was really funny coming from, you know, Pat Conroy. He's, all his books are really big.
Uh-huh.
So I knew I'd written a very hefty book when Pat Conroy said, man, it's a big book. So
he's a very sweet guy. My guest is James M. Scott. His book is Target Tokyo. There's so much drama here. We have the drama of these guys taken off from the deck. And for those of us who don't know the story, every time another bomber takes off and flies away this long distance because they've been spotted by the Japanese, so they're taking off much further away from Japan than they had planned. And the fuel consumption is a crucial element in this. And yet they're 800 miles away instead of 500, and they have to take off. And we're waiting for one of the planes to crash. We're waiting for one of them not to get off the deck. And there really aren't any mishaps until the final plane.
Yeah, no, it's a, you know, they've managed to pull it off. I mean, Doolittle was, you know, Doolittle went first too, which I think just really reaffirming just what kind of amazing heroic figure he was. He, you know, he says, not only am I going to lead these guys on this mission and figure out the logistics and the physics and things like that involved, but I'm also going to be the first guy up there on what's going to be the scariest event because I need to show these men how, that I can do it, and it'll give them confidence. I mean, again, just a very selfless leader. And they do. They take off one after the other and without incident, and they get finally to the last one. And you have to remember, it's on that carrier deck at that point. They're in the middle of this really horrible storm. I mean, water's coming up over the bow of the carrier. It's windy. It's raining. I mean, it's just a really awful weather out there, and the engines are all roaring and whatnot. And this young American seaman ends up stumbling into one of the props, and it ultimately it nearly severs his arm, and he falls down, and immediately men run to him and grab him and try to help him and treat him. And one of the men who actually grabs him is one of the Doolittle Raiders who's about to climb up into that plane to take off. And even as this guy is very badly injured and ultimately is going to lose his arm as a result of this, he still tells this raider, you know, to go and give it to the Japanese for him. And so it's a really powerful scene, and in the Doolittle story.
And then we track each plane. This is so fascinating. You follow each plane one by one as they're approaching Japan and where they're going, and the conversations that are taking place between the crew members and their observations, and some of them are lost. Some of them aren't finding the landmarks that they're expecting. Other ones do just fine, and they're finding the things that they're looking for. But it's so fascinating to have these guys looking down and observing, and a lot of them are flying very low to the ground. And even though the Japanese have spotted them, they are observing that people are waving at them and being friendly. It's bizarre.
Oh, yeah. Well, and again, it really gets at the idea that the Japanese public had been convinced by their leadership that they were invincible and that an attack by the Americans was just out of question. And so when they see these bombers come flying over, you know, their first thought is, well, they're ours. So, you know, so of course they're going to wave. And, you know, they have no idea that these are American bombers that are coming over. And, you know, not until even actually when the attack starts over Tokyo, and a lot of people thought it was a drill. And instead of running for shelter, they ran outside to see what was going on. And so it had, and that was part of the success of the operation. Since one of the, you know, 16 bombers, you know, with each carrying four bombs each, can't have a huge impact on a city, you know, the size of Tokyo, but it can have a very big psychological impact on the people. And I think that in the U.S. knew that, and that was a big part of the raid. And so is to undermine that confidence that the Japanese leaders had instilled in their people that they were immune from these kinds of attacks. So one of the wonderful things, the Doolittle Raiders actually, a lot of, you know, over the years, because the raid is so iconic when it comes for World War II stories, that a number of them have been interviewed over the years by their hometown newspapers, and they've done various oral histories with the Air Force or the Air Force Academy. So there's a wonderful wealth of material for these men in their own words. One of the things you note in the book is the dialogue and the quotes and things like that. When I'm writing a book like this, you know, I can paraphrase all of that, but I would rather put it in the men's, have them say it in their own words. It's just more powerful. It's more intimate. they can tell you their experience better than I can paraphrase it. And so whenever I, you know, I'm writing these kinds of stories, I'm looking for those good quotes and those kinds of moments that I can put them in there, because I think that makes that history that much more real, that much more personal, and it gives readers a connection to these men.
James M. Scott joins us. His book is Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. And if you're listening to this interview on Saturday, April 18th, then it is the 73rd anniversary of that day when the Doolittle Raiders attacked Japan and changed the course of the war. You tell us that, as we already know, war is hell. Some of these bombs hit innocent people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's the thing, you have to remember, Japan at that time period had no real sense of what we know today as sort of modern zoning, if you will. So it was nothing for the Japanese to put a munitions factory right next to an elementary school or a bunch of houses by a steel mill. It was just a hodgepodge. And it was an incredibly dense city. In fact, it was one of the densest in the world. You had about 100,000 people in certain areas of Tokyo per square mile. So you had all of this, you know, these munitions targets and industrial targets and everything crowded in this very tight city in which all the residents lived all right around it. And so, you know, this is an era before precision-guided weapons. I mean, really, you know, you dropped your bomb and, you know, gravity did the rest. And so if you were off 50 feet, it could mean the difference of hitting a steel mill or, you know, hitting a apartment building. And so, you know, Japanese records that we have gotten today and studies, more recent Japanese studies that have been done, show, you know, that there was a lot of that kind of civilian damage. Now, don't get me wrong, the raiders destroyed a lot of their military targets and things like that. But there was, you know, there were some casualties. There were some innocents who were killed and even some children. And Doolittle actually was interviewed during the war crimes trials afterwards. And I think he kind of said it best. He said, you know, when you do have civilians all living in those tight areas, I mean, sometimes, you know, that's going to be a byproduct of these kinds of bombings. And so, that did happen. None of the Doolittle raiders set out to kill civilians or anything like that. It was just it had a lot to do with the way in which Japan's cities were structured and the way they were the way they developed.
And prior to the raids, there was some discussion. A number of these flyers passed right over the Imperial Palace, and there was some discussion about bombing the emperor, but they didn't want to do that.
No, some of these guys were cutting cards to figure out who was going to be the one to get to bomb the emperor. And Doolittle was adamant, and he said, "No one's going to touch the emperor. Period. That is an order." And he, you know, by bombing the emperor, he realized you would only rally the people around the Japanese leadership if you targeted the leadership, and that's not what they wanted to do. They didn't want to rally the Japanese. They wanted to make the average Japanese people question their leadership, question their leaders who had taken them into this war. And so by avoiding bombing the emperor, they, you know, could help hopefully drive a wedge between the people and the Japanese military and the Japanese political leadership. And so he was adamant about that. In fact, Doolittle and a lot of the flyers flew right by it. They would tell you, we could see the muddy moats, the muddy moat that went around it. So, but they all passed on bombing it.
This is an amazing story. Target Tokyo. James M. Scott wrote it. Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. And that raid took place on April 18th, 1942. And if you're listening to this on Saturday, April 18th, James will be in Dayton for the big event today, the big event at the Air Force Museum. The last two surviving raiders will be there today on this anniversary, April 18th. And should be quite a day.
Yeah.
These guys, most of them crashed. Most of them were trying to get to China. One guy realized that his fuel consumption was so high, he couldn't make it to China. This guy ended up landing in Russia. And that is, I think, one of the more bizarre parts of this whole story.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the United States, originally, it would have been wondrous if the raiders could have all just flown from Japan to Russia at that time, because the distances were a lot less. It was only about 675 miles from the from Russia to Tokyo. But at that time, the Russians and the Japanese had a neutrality pact, and so had we flown to Russia intentionally, it would have put the Russians in an awkward situation of allowing the Americans to bomb the Japanese homeland and then come to Russia, and it would have opened up the Russians to attack by the Japanese. And at that point, the Russians were already battling the Germans, and so they just didn't want to have a two-front war. What happened actually is all the Raiders bombers had these very specially adjusted carburetors, except for one of the bombers. They some mechanics swapped out the carburetor right before the mission without realizing it. And so as this air crew was flying into Tokyo, they realized they were just burning through their fuel at a highly accelerated rate, so much so that by the time they actually got to Tokyo and did their bombing, they realized there was no way they had enough fuel to even make it anywhere near China. And so they diverted to Russia against orders. Doolittle had, again, barred anybody from flying there, but they realized that that was their only hope if they wanted to survive. So they went to Russia, where they ended up being interned for about 13 months by the Russians. And then in one of the greatest stories, they ultimately escaped. they ended up being interned, and they ultimately had appealed to be put in a more southern, warmer climate, and the Russians finally relented and moved them all the way down, and they were ultimately able to escape across the border and out of Russia, so where they were quickly taken in by the British and offered up scotch.
Right.
It's a great story.
They went into Iran, didn't they?
They did, yes, yeah. They did. And they had to bribe a smuggler to help sneak them out and across the border. So it's an amazing. That's what the thing about the Doolittle Raid is. There's just so many great adventure stories off of it. I mean, on the one hand, it's the story of Pearl Harbor, and then it's the story of this, politics of how do we strike back. It's the story of planning this raid against all odds, and then you have, after the raid, you have the raid, and then afterwards you have, one crew ends up in Russia, others end up bailing out at nighttime, some crash land. I mean, there's so many adventure stories packed into one that it's an incredible story.
And it's like they've flown back in time 1,000 years. So many of these guys ended up struggling to survive after crashing in these primitive areas, and one crew in particular, these guys were terribly injured. This one guy, it's just heartbreaking to hear what happened to him. This man who suffered the facial injuries and ended up losing a leg.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's actually, that was Ted Lawson who and his crew, and they crash-landed. They were actually trying to land and ultimately crashed right on the coast of China on this island. And four out of the five were badly injured, and miraculously, one of the men was a young gunner, actually, Dave Thatcher, who's one of the two who's still alive today. And so here he was, this very young gunner who has these horrifically injured flyers with him, and he's got to help get these guys, with the help of these Chinese guerrillas, off this island and into safety. And as you mentioned, Ted Lawson is. His teeth have been knocked out. He's lost nine of them. His leg is gashed. And ultimately, he's going to have to be amputated in this rural hospital. It's just these were horrific injuries. And in China at that point, it was a very primitive area where these guys came down. And you also have to remember, at that time, a lot international travel was not common. And so, a lot of these airmen had never, been outside their state, some of them even the counties where they'd grown up or hadn't traveled much outside those areas. And so, here you were taking them from, sort of their experience in America and dropping them into a very primitive China. And they were so unprepared. One of them had this great quote. He said, "Well, I just figured whenever I bailed out, I'd come down, I'd walk down the street to the nearest gas station. I'd just call somebody to come pick me up." Well, there was nobody you could call. I mean, you came down in these villages where people, the only mode of transportation were, rickshaws and miniature ponies even. And you had these guys scattered across several hundred miles. So, that's what I'm saying. And each one of those crews had these great adventures. Some of them were very, tragic, and some of the air crews were captured by the Japanese. Two of them were. Others, like Ted Lawson and his crew, were badly injured. And then a lot of the others actually were miraculously were totally unhurt. So, but everybody had their own unique adventure when they got to China.
And it should be pointed out, I think, that these guys, they chose to participate in this, but then they ended up thrusting themselves into the lives of these ordinary Chinese and all these random areas where they landed. They encountered these Chinese who some of them had never seen a Caucasian before, and some of them were just as heroic as these flyers. They protected them. They sheltered them. They risked their lives to take care of them.
Absolutely, they did. I mean, these guys, the reason that they survived was because of the generosity and the aid given to them by local villagers, by missionaries, by guerrillas. Because, you know, these guys came down and they were totally disoriented. And they were, you know, they had to have people that could lead them out and to help them get where they needed to go. And so and these folks did that. And they really were very heroic. And they gave the raiders, you know, a lot of these were very impoverished areas. They gave the raiders, you know, the precious food that they had and things of that nature to really help take care of them. So they were definitely the Chinese were definitely the unsung heroes in helping these raiders.
The book is Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. James M. Scott wrote it. He joins us on the program today. And as we read this, these guys are struggling. They've crashed in various spots. They're trying to make their way to safety. That they're going up and looking for people to try to help them. They're knocking on doors, and they know this very rudimentary a couple of words to try to identify themselves. And they're actually looking at people's feet to try to determine, well, are they Chinese or Japanese?
Yeah, it's because the Chinese and the Japanese wore different types of sandals. So they were actually told this trick by the intelligence officer on the Hornet that depending on the type of sandal they wore, you could tell if it was a Japanese soldier or not, or a Chinese. And these guys were just really, I think, not only were the Doolittle Raiders out of their element, but I think, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of the Chinese villagers were just stunned by these men that just showed up. You know, some of them, in fact, there are a couple of great stories, I think, where some of the Chinese people would see the raiders, and they'd never seen a Caucasian person before. And one of the raiders in particular was a really tall guy, and this villager just turned around and took off running away, just so stunned by this 6'4" American airman who's landed in front of him. So, yeah.
James, how did you get into this line of work?
I was a newspaper reporter for a number of years. I should actually back up and say I spent my first year out of college as an English teacher in Japan. So I went to Japan and I taught at the junior high level, and I was a public school teacher, which I think has actually been a really big help for me because it's given me a real great perspective, I think, into Japanese culture and whatnot. And so then I came back and I ended up as a newspaper reporter for a number of years, and I worked as a military reporter. And I always knew I wanted to write books. And so, in fact, my first book, The Attack on the Liberty, was about my dad's ship in the Navy. And then I did that one. And then I left newspaper reporting at that point, and I wrote a second book on the submarine war in the Pacific, The War Below, which came out in 2013. And then the Target Tokyo, which is out this week. And then I'm working on another book now that's due next year on the Battle for Manila, February 1945.
Oh, my. Do you have to go to the Philippines to do your research?
I do. Yeah, I'm actually headed over there later this year. I've been really lucky that there's just an amazing document trail in the American Archives here in the National Archives, the MacArthur Archives, and there are also a number of survivors of the Battle of Manila who live in the United States that I've already been able to talk to and interview. But there's several archives over there, and a number of people I want to be able to go over and talk with. So I'm going to head over there this fall. And for folks who may not be aware, the Battle for Manila was the most violent urban fight of the entire Pacific War, and it was a 29-day battle that led to the deaths of about 100,000 civilians and the near total loss of the city of Manila, which had been at that point just this amazingly beautiful city. And by the time the battle was over, it was completely leveled. So it was just a really hellacious fight, and in a lot of ways, it hasn't ever really recovered. So. But it happened late in the war, and it didn't get a lot of attention back then. And so we're hoping we can bring some attention to it now. So it's in that. You have to remember, a lot of the fighting in the Pacific theater had been a lot of jungle fighting in places like New Guinea and things like that. So whereas this was, literally fought in city parks, people's backyards. I mean, house to house. I mean, this was just a real urban fight.
And I imagine Ferdinand Marcos will be in this.
No, I mean, so far not.
He was a guerrilla fighter, wasn't he?
Yeah, but so, I mean, I'm still kind of digging in on some of this. So we'll see. But the book's actually going to have a real tight focus on just that 29-day period.
So okay.
Really, it's going to open up right when the Americans are kind of coming into Manila.
What kind of access did you have to survivors of the Doolittle Raid? How many of them were you able to talk to?
I was able to talk to several of them. You know, I started working on the book back several years ago, and there were a few more of them were still living at that time. And so the ones that I interviewed, like Dick Cole and Dave Thatcher and Tom Griffin, I mean, they were just phenomenally generous with their time. And, you know, the thing about the Doolittle Raiders is they today remain in high demand. I mean, they, you know, if schools, rotary clubs, events, things like that, love to have them. And so they've really, you know, they get a lot of these invites. And so to be able to get as much time as I did from them, and I had a lot of wonderful help from some of the family members as well, was really terrific. You know, being able to hear their stories and being able to hear, you know, like talking to Dick Cole, it's amazing to hear the man who sat next to Jimmy Doolittle talk about what that raid was like that day. Mm. You know, you can read their reports and things like that, but when you get a chance to meet them and speak to them, it's just, it's pretty amazing.
You have a number of photos in the book, and the very last one is a photo of Chase Nielsen taken in 1946. And when we hear what he endured and when we see this photo, it's just, it's so powerful.
Yeah, you know, Nielsen was one of the ones who was captured. And the Japanese, eight other raiders were captured out of the 80. And of those, the Japanese held sort of a mock trial that lasted about 30 minutes. I use the word trial with quote marks around it because it was nothing like a real trial. But they decided that they were going to execute them. They executed three of them, and they put the other five in prison for life in prison. One of those five, Bob Meter, actually starved to death in prison. And the other four spent the next 40 months in Japanese prison camps. And much of that time was spent in solitary confinement. They were beaten. They were waterboarded. They were starved. I mean, it was a pretty horrific experience. And then they were only liberated at the war's end. And so, you know, for some of the raiders, the Doolittle Raid was just one mission out of many. But for those raiders who were captured and that survived, that one raid became the war for them. They suffered greatly. And then in the end, Chase Nielsen came back and was sort of the star witness in the war crimes case against several of the Japanese who had participated in the trial and in the execution of the other raiders. And so the photograph that you mentioned is actually the warden of the prison, one of the prisons where they were, and the executioner from the execution of the others, bowing to him as he's now the witness in the prosecution against him. So it's a very powerful photo, for sure.
That's right. This Doolittle Raid took place early enough in the war that some of these guys made it back and went right back to war, and some of them died before the war ended.
Yeah, there were 80 raiders total, and 61 of them survived the war. So 19 of them died. Three of them died actually on the raid itself, and then one more. Three died on during bailout. Three were executed, one starved, and then the others died elsewhere in the war. Some of the raiders, it's interesting, some of the raiders ended up as POWs of the Germans. You know, and so they went and flew in the European theater and were captured over there. So, yeah, these guys ended up having very, very varied experiences.
Well, it's quite a story. And if you're listening to this interview on Saturday, April 18th, it is the 73rd anniversary of the raid. Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor, tells us all about it. James M. Scott wrote it, and he will be in Dayton today for a big day at the Air Force Museum. Tell us what's going on again.
Yeah, the last two surviving Doolittle Raiders, Dick Cole and Dave Thatcher, are going to be in Dayton today. They're going to be installing the Congressional Gold Medal, which the is being presented this week by Congress to them, into the permanent display of the for the Doolittle Raiders at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force. And so I'll be there. I got an invite to the event, and I'll be there all day signing books as well for folks who are interested in reading Target Tokyo.
And while we're recording this, you're in Washington, D.C., and I'm guessing that you've been participating in some events related to the book there. What's been going on?
Yeah, actually, we start tonight. There's going to a number of the Rader families are here in town. Tomorrow, Congress is going to award them the Congressional Gold Medal, and so there's a dinner tonight. And then we've got the event tomorrow at 3 p.m., and then I'm doing a book signing at Politics and Prose and a talk on the book tomorrow night at 7 p.m. So yeah, there's some fun things happening in Washington this week. So I'm going to do a little raid.
What has it been like working on this project and finally having the book come out? How does that feel?
It feels great. I'll tell you, it's such – the Doolittle Raid is just – it's such a great story that I know it's probably a cliche, but it kind of writes itself. I mean, it's just it's such an adventure story that putting it on paper took very little effort. I mean, it's such a fascinating story. That said, it's still – the research and the writing took several years, and I'm very excited for the book to be out this week. Very excited for people who don't know about this story to be introduced to this story, to read about what these amazing American airmen went through and what they did for the nation. I think it's the greatest story of World War II. And I hope others agree, and I hope it'll bring new people to that story.
And for readers of this book, you'll recognize fairly quickly that Dayton, Ohio was a very important part of the story.
Absolutely. Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. I mean, that's, Jimmy Doolittle went there and he sought out help on how to reconfigure the bombers to be able to take more fuel and whatnot. I mean, it was there's very much a big local Dayton connection to the story. Absolutely.
And when I started reading it and I saw the reference to Shangri-La, I thought of Mitchell Zukov's book. He also had a book about World War II, and there was a right connection there with Dayton. And I didn't realize that FDR had been having some fun with Shangri-La, but we'll leave that to readers to discover what that's all
Absolutely.
About.
Absolutely.
We really appreciate your time today, James.
Vic, the pleasure is all mine.
The book is Target Tokyo, Jimmy Doolittle, and the Raid That Avenged Pearl Harbor. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks for listening.